hit the point of talking about dynamic. Before yesterday, we looked at torques and how to compute torque and equilibrium problems. Okay? Torque can be computed as force times moment arm. If I have a net torque acting on a body, there will be rotational acceleration. Okay, the relationship between the torque and the angular acceleration is given by this analog to Newton's second law, or you could call it Newton's second law for rotational motion. That torque is equal to I alpha. This looks like F equals ma. The analog to F is torque, the analog to alpha, and now the analog to m, which before was a measure of inertia of a body moving in a straight line, is now given by this rotational analog, the moment of inertia. We started out by showing that the moment of inertia of a point mass going around in a circle, right, and accelerating is given by mr squared. We derive that, so I is equal to the mass times r squared. And more extended bodies, the moment of inertia becomes a little more difficult to compute. So even this little disk here, okay, what you have to do is chop this up into little pieces, and if I want to rotate this about its center of mass, I have to ask how far is each little piece away. That's its r. Right, take the mass times r squared, add them up for every little chunk of this, okay, and using calculus, one can obtain the moment of inertia for this object. Even with this slit, we could try to figure out how that slit affects things. For nice geometric shapes, things that come up often enough that we can do problems with them, okay, there's a whole table in your text. I did not write down everything from the table. These are the typical ones that come up. A sphere is 2/5 the mass of the sphere times its radius squared. All of these look like mr squared. The moment of inertia has units of what? What would the moment of units be for this? Mass is kilograms. Radius would be meters squared. So you always have something with a mass times a squared distance, kgm squared. That would be the unit for the moment of inertia. All of these look like the mass times some characteristic length. Right? For a cylinder, a hoop, a disc, that characteristic distance is a radius, right? They all have a radius. For the rod, which often talk about meter sticks and things like that. So if you look at a nice rectangular shape like a door, okay, if I have that door spinning around, okay, one could also use this formula for that. Okay, as you notice, note from your table. Okay, so all of these look like the mass times square distance with a different constant. Right? So all we have to do is know what the constants are. Okay, now we can make use of this. One way you can make use of it, of course, is if you know what the torque is acting on a body, you can compute the acceleration. We did a problem like that for a disk the other day. Okay. We did another type of problem in which we introduced notions of rotational kinetic energy. If I have an object that's rolling, it takes some energy to get it to roll. Okay, so we looked at a sphere rolling down an incline. So here's a sphere rolling down the incline, and we assume rolling without slipping, which means that the translational velocity, or the velocity of its center of mass, okay, is the radius times its angular velocity of rotating and spinning. So we have an object like this disk could be spinning around. Okay, but if it's sitting on a tabletop, it'll be moving. Okay, or if it's rolling without slipping. So you have translational motion, which we dealt with actually in an earlier chapter, because we always had bodies going, right, moving through a distance with some c speed, we can compute 1/2 mv². That is its translational kinetic energy, but now we have the 1/2 I omega². If I have a hoop rotating, right, if I've got all this mass and it's all, let's assume the slot's not there, it's all distributed like this, okay, it takes a certain amount of energy for it to move. But what if all that mass were on the rim? I pushed it all out, right? Sort of like a really thin donut. Okay. Then, as that's rolling, right, it takes more, different amount of energy. Okay, so what we did here was we said, all right, kinetic energy is going to be a translational part plus a rotational part. Okay, so if it's moving forward, that's translating. If it's spinning, it's rotating. If it's moving without slipping, there's a connection here. Okay, and then I went through and said, all right, for a sphere, I put in I. What do I get? 2/5 mr². R squared omega squared is V squared, so this all combines nice and neat to give me 7/10 mv² is the kinetic energy for a rolling sphere. So that comes up fairly often, so one can actually write that down quickly if one remembers it. If you don't remember it, then you can just derive it. What did I ask you at the end of the class? Right, what moves faster going down a slope? Okay, well, the example we did was we compared the sphere to a box going down, and of course people were amazed. All right, and so one could think of it the following way, right, because it's unbelievable a box would go down an incline faster than a sphere rolling down it. One of the reasons is because most of your life experiences of any box are going down inclines is that there was friction. So friction slowed it down. But if you look at our derivation back when we did the original box going down an incline that was frictionless, we also said that that box, all it depends on is the distance. So I could just drop the box the same height. Now imagine dropping that box that height at the same time a sphere is rolling down. Maybe, you know, you might begin to believe that, oh yeah, well maybe that does work that way.
But why?
Because that's the way it is. Okay. The question is why? Well, let's look at it this way. This has the same potential energy the box had, right? That has to use some of that energy to go from the this top height down to the bottom. But it also needs to borrow some of that energy to rotate, so it doesn't have as much energy to go forward. So that's the basic idea. Okay. Now the question is, what happens if I replace that sphere with a disk? Like one of, again, here's a disk. Just pretend the slot's not there. So I've got this disk going down the hill, and I have a sphere going down the hill. And the question is, how would that change things? Would we expect this disk to get down faster than the sphere? What would change in the problem? The 1/5. Okay, so 2/5 becomes a 1/2. Right? The moment of inertia has changed. So it takes a different amount of energy for the disk to go down than this the sphere. So I replace that with a 1/2. So for a disk, what do we have? Kinetic energy is 1/2 mv² plus, now what factor do I have? 1/4. 1/2 × 1/2 = 1/4 mv². 1/2 + 1/4 = 3/4. Now if I take the kinetic energy, now which is 3/4 mv² down here, and solve for how fast this is going, given that it started at height 8, right, I said Pe equal to Ke. This way to give me the velocity, well, set that equal to mgh, bring the 3/4 to the other side, you get the square root of something gh. What would that something be? What number do I put in here? If I set this equal to mgh, I get 4/3. Okay, how does 4/3 compare to 7/10? Or 10, well, when I solve this, I got 10/7. Good enough. So here we got the square root of 10 over 7 GH yesterday.
10 over 7 is
1 and 3 sevenths. 7 and a 30 is 4, so it's about 1.4. 4 thirds is 1.3. So which gets down faster? Which is bigger, 1.3 or 1.4? 1.4, right? 10 sevenths is bigger than 4 thirds, so the square is moving faster. Okay? So now you can ask the same thing of the hoop. Replace the 2 fifths with a 1 now, and see if you can guess, okay, out of the 3 of them, or basically, what order the 3 of them would go down. What if I change the radius of the hoop compared to the sphere? How would that affect things? How would that affect this result if I change the radius? There's no radius. How about the mass? So ideally, those things don't matter. Okay, there's one other topic about moments of inertia that I haven't covered in any detail. All of these are moments of inertia through the center of mass. There is something known as the parallel axis theorem, which I believe is in a homework problem, which allows you to ask what happens if instead of taking this meter stick and spinning it about its center, like you would with a baton, to take the meter stick and put the axis at the end. All right? The axis is no longer through the center. It will behave differently. Okay? So that's an example in the homework. All right, the last topic, angular momentum. I told you what angular momentum was by way of formula, but I didn't say much more. What is the linear momentum? What's the formula for linear momentum? Right. Momentum is mass times velocity. G equals mv. We just had that recently. Was that last week? I forget what it was. Okay. I would like to introduce the angular momentum. Okay, the angular momentum, we replace m with its analog. What's the analog to m?
I.
What's the analog to v?
Omega.
So the angular momentum is I omega. We'd like to be nice if they just put p, but somebody introduced a new letter for angular momentum, so we're going to call it l. So there's the angular momentum. Very similar to linear momentum. So we have an object that has a certain distribution of mass that's represented by I, and it's rotating at a certain angular velocity, so many radians per second. Okay? One of the key things we did with linear momentum was the conservation principle. Alright, so we had the principle of the conservation of linear momentum, which said that sometimes momentum is conserved, right? Condition was that the net force acting on a system was zero. Okay? The conservation of angular momentum is very similar. Conservation of angular momentum says the net something has to be zero. What do you think that would be? What would I replace force with? Torque. So if the net torque, external torque, is equal to zero, then the total momentum of initially will be equal to the total angular momentum, final. Okay. So there are various
applications of this
type of problem.
All right? Another way to write this is to look at I omega before, initially. So what can we do? We can look at a particular system. Its angular velocity has a certain value. Something's rotating at so many radians per second. And then we can look afterwards, and we have I times omega f. It could be rotating differently, but I can't set these equal yet because the I's would cancel, and it would tell me that omega I is omega f. That doesn't, that would contradict the fact that they change. So in order for the angular momentum to change, the moment of inertia has to change. So the moment of inertia can change as well in our system. Okay. So a typical example that's used is a skater. Okay. Or maybe a ballerina. But normally a skater would be much easier because they're on ice and we don't have that external work to worry about yet.
For the second inertia there, is it supposed to be inertia final?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It doesn't have. Okay. Just think that someday you'll get up here and do the same thing. Right? Write things on the board. Try to talk at the same time you're writing. Try to think about what you're going to say next, etc. And think about, you know, where you're ending up. And you're bound to make some mistakes. So that's why you have to catch these things. Okay. Where was I? I was talking about an ice skater. You had an ice skater spinning around with their arms, and then they pull their arms in, and what happens? They go faster. This is an example of a conservation of angular momentum. Initially, the ice skater is going at some omega. The initial I corresponds to the arms being outstretched, right? These are some masses at some distance from the axis of rotation, namely the body. As you pull the arms in, what happens? The moment of inertia changes. Remember, the moment of inertia, if I just think of, I know she could do this much better if she had two big heavy weights in her hands, right? Think of those two heavy weights. They're a certain distance away. MR squared, MR squared. Bring them in, the R's change, right? So my MR squareds are smaller. So my initial moment of inertia decreases in order for this constant to be constant. The omega f has to go up, okay, which means she goes faster. Likewise, throw your arms out, you get the same effect. All right, let's do a similar type of an example. Well, there must be too much moisture in here today because the truck keeps breaking. All right, we're going to look at a merry-go-round. Everybody remembers those? Let's say take a 1,500 kilogram meters squared . What is 1,500 kilogram meters squared? It's the moment of inertia. Okay. A 40 kilogram kid jumps onto the merry-go-round. One meter from the axis. It is rotating at 2 degrees. OK.
Okay, so you're familiar with this, right? You were kids once. Okay? Or you'll have kids, or you have kids, right? What happens? You get there, you start running, get that merry-go-round going really, really fast, right? And then you jump on it, and then you're disappointed. Why? Because once you get on it, it doesn't seem like you're going as fast. Ever have that experience? You know? Then you get off, and you run again, and you try to get it going, and you jump on it, and not going as fast. All right, another kid jumps on it, really slows down. Okay? Assuming, of course, that, you know, there's not too much external force from the bearings and you know, the rust and whatever. Okay? This is a nice example of conservation of angular momentum. So let's look at this. The initial angular momentum in this case, omega sub i. The moment of inertia initially is a 1,500 kilogram meters squared value for the merry-go-round, right? So this could be a disk, or, you know, somebody could give you the radius and the mass, whatever. But let's assume, right, we already know what I is. Omega sub I is 2 radians per second. So if I computed these, I get 1,500 kilogram meters squared, multiply that times 2.0 radians per second. And what do we get? 2 times 1,500 is 3,000 kilograms meters squared per second. L final is, of course, I final omega final. I could have just set this up, you know, one die on one side, one on the other side. I want to concentrate on how do we compute this. What I'm interested in, I didn't ask a question, did I? Well, we know what the question is. What's the question? What is the final angular momentum? I mean, angular velocity. Okay, so let's think about the problem. We have a merry-go-round going around. A kid jumps on here. Let's say we have a point kid. We're going to treat the kid as a point because I don't want to compute, you know, the arms flying around and all that, what the angular of the moment of inertia is for that. So we got a kid jumps on here 1 meter away from the center. That's my new system. Now the kid is also rotating. So my moment of inertia consists of the 1,500 to start plus the kid going around. And if I treat the kid as a point mass, then what's the moment of inertia of a point mass? MR squared. So for your notes, we'll put that in, MR squared. The mass of the kid is 40. R is 1. So this contribution is a total of 40. So we have 1,500 plus 40 is 1,540. Okay. So that's what we want to do is visualize how does I change. I goes up, it's bigger, right? So therefore, omega must go down. So we have Li is equal to Lf. Li was 3,000. Now this is 1,540 omega F. Omega F is 3,000 over 1,540. or what? 1.9. Doesn't seem like much of a change. 1.9 what?
Radians
per second. So that's the basic idea of conservation of angular momentum. Now we can get a lot more examples of this in practice, but it'll take a bit more explanation. So, all right. So that pretty much wraps up some of the key things in dynamics in physics. Okay, we've looked at linear dynamics, rotational dynamics. Okay, we're going to look at a few more things next. In the next chapter, we're going to look at something that's relatively important. Well, everything's important, right? Let's see, this is chapter 10. In this chapter, we are going to look at and follow it up in the lab. We're going to look at simple harmonic motion. Examples that display simple harmonic motion. For the most part, what we're looking at are oscillations, and oscillations are really actually important, okay, in a lot of aspects. So we're going to be looking at oscillations in their simplest form, and we're going to do this by starting out with an ideal. Everybody's had a spring in their hands at one point or another. So here's a spring. Alright. The idea is I pull down on that spring, the spring pulls back up. Some springs are fairly tight, right, and it's hard to pull them. And so we're going to investigate that type of behavior. If I take a particular mass, hang it on here, it stretches down. This is now in equilibrium, right? Gravity is pulling down, the spring is pulling back up. Okay, if I add more mass to this, all right, it stretches more. Okay, and it's still in equilibrium. Okay, so that's the first thing we want to look at. Okay, is the spring force. So here's my spring. We'll attach some mass to this spring. We will assume that's in equilibrium. Okay, as compared to how the spring looked before, this spring has been deformed. Another topic in this chapter has to do with deformations, and we'll see when we get to the end of the chapter, the last topic. Alright, let's assume that this spring was a little higher up to begin with. There's this the unstretched position of the spring. Okay, so this is unstretched. And now I put the mass in, and this has been stretched by some distance. X. Force is acting. We have a downward force, which our text refers to as an applied force. And we have the spring pulling back up. We'll call that FS. That's the spring force. Okay, or a restoring force. So it's a spring force or a restoring force pulling up on it.
If I add more mass, X gets bigger. Of course, we can do an experiment. And we can look at the relationship between these forces, okay, and the distance that this has been stretched. In the lab, we're going to call this elongation. Look at the elongation of this. Or we could call this the position of mass m as it's going up and down. Okay? We can also align the springs so that they're horizontal. Okay? If I do horizontals, then I can just pull with a particular force and I don't have to think about gravity. If it's up vertical, right, then gravity is the main force usually that one has to look at. Okay, so F is a function . So what we can do is we can go into the lab and get a meter stick and we can make measurements. Alright, the mass is not here, I can measure where this is, and then I can put some mass on here. Now measure how far that's been stretched, figure out how much it's been stretched by, put some more mass on there, and see what happens. And if I put more mass on it, okay, we find out that there's a relationship for an ideal spring. Typically, you will get a graph that looks something like this. All right, put the elongation here. Put the applied force over on this axis, that force that's in newtons, the elongation x, let's say that's in meters, and we go ahead and we get some data points. Well, let's see. It's not stretched if there's no force being applied to it. And then we get some more data, and right, I add a force, find out where how much it's stretched. Add another force, that's basically just add more masses. And since this is just gravity acting, in this case, my plus, what is the applied force?
Mg.
All right, so this is mg for the case where I have a string with some mass hanging on it. Okay? Horizontal, then I have to measure how much I'm pulling it or whatever. All right, so we get some data. For an ideal string, the data will look like that. What does that remind you of? What kind of a function do you think, what kind of relationship do you think we have here? Linear. And guess what? That's what we're going to do. We're going to get a linear relationship, okay, between the two of these, and ideally there should be no intercept because it's not stretched when there's no force applied to it. Okay, how would I express this relationship? How do you express a linear relationship? Straight line form, right? In building across the way, right, you see it's y equals mx plus b, right? So in this case, what is my y? F. Alright, you're going to get F is proportional to X. And there's no intercept, right? Y-intercept is zero. So the relationship here we get is that the applied force is proportional to X, or it's equal to X times a constant. We're going to put K in here for the constant. Alright, the slope, what is the slope of this line? Okay. K has a name. K is called the spring constant. K is not negative. K is positive. Does K have units?
No. Maybe.
See, if you solve that for k, what do you get? F over x. If you look over here for the slope, you have to compute rise over run. So what are the units of the rise? For the run?
Meters.
So does k have units?
Yes.
Newtons per meter. Okay, so the spring constant does have this. In this particular case where we have the weight, right, we've got F applied down, Fs up. If these are in equilibrium, then these two forces are equal in magnitude, in opposite direction, right? Fs is opposite direction to this. So if I were to look at the restoring force, the restoring force is going to have the same magnitude, opposite direction. So this is the force being supplied by the spring. This is the spring force. And that negative makes sense. If I have a positive increase in x, right, if I stretch it, that force acts opposite to the stretching. But if I were to compress my spring, then the spring pushes, right? So if I compress the spring instead of stretching it, x is negative. I get negative times a negative, I get a positive. So that negative sign ensures that the force that the spring exerts is opposite to the stretching. So if I stretch it, the force tries to pull it back up. If I compress it, it tries to push it away. Okay, this law is called Hooke's law. Named after Robert Hooke, who is a contemporary. All right, so in the lab, what we're going to do is precisely that experiment, because we can determine for a particular spring what the spring constant is. If that were all springs were about, okay, then we'd be done. But that's not what they're all about. Because not only can I attach a mass to a spring like this one, I can, right, and stretch it to an equilibrium. I can ask, what if I push it out of equilibrium? Let me push it down a little bit and let go. And what does it do? It bounces, okay? It goes up and down and up and down and up and down. If it's an ideal spring, what it will do is, right, if I have equilibrium here, right, the mass there, I pull it down, I let go, it's going to go back up. Basically, what I've done is pulled it down and stored energy. It's going to come back up, speed up, and try to get back to equilibrium. But the problem is, once it gets back to equilibrium level, it's got some velocity. It's going to keep going. It's going to push up, compress the spring, but now the spring's fighting it, slows it down, and then pushes it back. And it just keeps going back and forth like this. And if it's an ideal spring, it's going to go down to where it started, go back up the same amount, the other side of equilibrium, and just keep oscillating back and forth between those two points. And so therefore, it will be periodic, which means we can determine what the period of oscillation is. Let me get some masses. Unfortunately, this table doesn't have a lip that I can put this on. All right, but you can kind of see that the motion of this spring. If I put less mass on there, let's see what it does. Do we notice any difference? Okay, let me put, I'm going to add mass. Unfortunately, that paper didn't. Okay, let me add some more mass. Do we notice any difference here? Okay. Is that any different than before? Well, it's stretched about the period. I've added more mass. It takes longer for it to go through its oscillation, doesn't it? Than it did before. In case you forgot, let me take a couple masses off. All right. You can see this is going up, down, up, down, up, down. All right. Let's see if we can let the sound help out here.
up, down, up, down. Okay. That sound like it's a corner?
Okay, a little bit more than that. Let's really load it up.
All right. Up, down, up, down. All right, more mass means bigger period. Okay, so we can talk about the period being the time it takes for an oscillation. So Hooke's law is fairly simple looking. Now we want to study the dynamics of the system. Okay. So let's see. Let's say this mass is sitting on here. This is now in equilibrium. That's the equilibrium position. We now pull the mass down a certain distance. And we let go. Okay, so at this point, gravity's pulling down, but the spring is pulling back more, right? At equilibrium, the force of gravity pulling down was equal to spring force. But now I pull this down more, which means that this is stretched even further from the natural state of the spring. Okay? So when I let go of it, there's a force that wants to restore this to equilibrium. So then it comes back up to this point. And this has maximum velocity. When you pull it down, it speeds up to that point. Then it starts to slow down because after that it compresses the spring. So there's a maximum velocity at this point, and then it compresses the spring as it goes up to a certain point where it stops. So over here, V is equal to zero. Back where I pulled it down, to zero. Turns out that the distance that this is from equilibrium at its lowest point is, we'll designate that as A. Right, that distance. If I come along here, the distance that this goes up before stopping is also A
in magnitude, right? Since I said distance.
So we take this, which is an equilibrium, I pull it down, and watch what happens. It goes up, speeds up at this point, slows down until it comes to a stop. Then that spring pushes it down, speeds up until this point, then as it gets down further, right now the spring is pulling up again. Okay? And so that's the type of behavior. And this goes over and over and over. This is periodic, which means that this motion happens over and over and over again. We can talk about the period of oscillation. We're just the period, and we've talked about period before. Remember when we had circular motion, we had a mass going around, right? I said the period was the time for it to go around one cycle, one revolution. Well, in this case, this is a cycle. The mass goes from here, goes up, comes back, right? The time it takes for it to go from here up and back is the period. We're going to call that period T. What are the units of period? Period is what? It's the time it takes to do something, right? So what do you think? Seconds. It's amazing how often I ask things, very simple questions like, what's the period given information, and people do not come up with that. All right, the period is measured in seconds. Okay? The other type of thing that we talk about has to do with the rapidity of this moving up and down, right? So this period, right, a long period is like this. A shorter period goes right like that. But instead of describing in terms of period, one often talks about the frequency of oscillation. So the frequency is another characteristic of this oscillation. So what is the frequency? The frequency is designated with a little f for frequency. Okay. The frequency is measured in units of cycles per second. Another unit for cycles per second, another way to write cycles per second is CPS. We talked about that actually a while ago. Cycles per second are also referred to as hertz. Hz, all right, it's not the same as the one that computes zetas. All right, this was named after Hertz, who was one of the first people to demonstrate electromagnetic waves. There's something that was predicted in around 1860 by Maxwell, and it wasn't until 27 years later. Okay, it's one of those things where somebody actually predicted something long before it's used. And of course, now that we have electromagnetic waves, we have all sorts of things like radio waves, MTV, microwave ovens, right, etc. All right, so frequency is another measure. The period basically is how many seconds per cycle. The frequency is how many cycles per second. Do we notice a similarity between those units? All right, one's the reciprocal of the other. So there is a nice relationship. The frequency is one over the period. Okay? All right, so it's nice to know that we have this periodic motion, but not all periodic motion is quite as nice as that of an ideal spring. We have different kinds of periodic behavior. What the simple harmonic motion has is a periodic behavior, which is known as sinusoidal. Sinusoidal behavior is the following. If I want to describe where that mass is as a function of time, I can do so using sines and cosines. That's what sinusoidal means. Okay? That is a special type of periodic motion. Most people think periodic, they think sinusoidal, but that's not everything that's periodic is sinusoidal. Okay? If you look at the teeth on a saw, go up and down, they repeat, but they will not be the same shape as this shape given by sine and cosine functions. In order for us to say a little more about this periodicity, we're going to try to do an experiment. How well this turns out. We're actually going to graph the data for this motion. Why don't we take a break while I do this? You guys would like 1 second to break. We get a chance to play with a spring in the lab today and get to do some of these same things. Okay? First off, there's Hooke's law. And Hooke's law tells me that the spring force is proportional to the elongation. This constant of proportionality is called the spring constant. The next thing I've noted is that if I put a mass on a spring and I pull it down and let it go, it will oscillate. Okay, it will go up and down, right? It has a period of oscillation and corresponding frequency. The frequency is 1 over the period. And then I said it's something about sinusoidal. Now this is a display. It though not one of the best looking displays I've seen, of this type of behavior. I have some mass sitting on the spring over there. We're going to try to repeat this, but I might as well show it in case I have a hard time lining this up. You know how demonstrations go in front of class. They don't always work the way you expect. So the idea here is that I have a mass on a spring that's going up and down. It's sitting over a sonar probe, very similar to the probe that you used in lab. All right? And this is position versus time. And you can see the position goes up and down and up and down like this. Somewhere in the middle here is the equilibrium position as that mass is going up and down. So we have the mass is going up and down. We're tracking how far it is from the probe. And as time goes on, it traces out a curve that looks like that. That is a sinusoidal curve. This one's got a few peaks and things. It's just the graphics. I could try to set the scale right and the amount of time that I watch it. But 20 seconds looks like it looks pretty good. Okay. So I could look at the time it takes for it to be at the bottom of this plot. It goes up and down. That's our cycle. Up, down. If I knew the time it took to go up and down, right, this time, if I could go through and grab that time, then I could say what the period is. So we can determine the period by the distance between the peaks or the valleys of this graph, because that's the amount of time it takes for one cycle. Okay, so I'm going to do this, have to do this again. We can see that this is, the one problem with trying to do this is that it likes to move back and forth, which is not so great. So let's try this. Wait, what happened to my display? This is fine with my mind. Like this for the probe, you're going to grab your own, you're going to have a wider, bigger
set of masses are going to go a lot slower, and you get to grab the period off of that and see what the behavior is. Now let me look at an applet, which of course is a little more reliable, but also more suggestive. So let me go jumping between machines here. So let me go to the desktop. In this case, I'm going to have to dim the lights a little bit because it's hard to see the colors. Very often, these applets are not meant to be projected, or if they were, they did a lousy job in their colors. Okay, what we're going to see here is a mass on a spring. Here's a vertical one. We're going to see a corresponding horizontal one. So over here will be the graph. As this is going up and down, it will graph the position as this mass is going up and down. There'll be a corresponding dot here, which is going to put both the position up and down of that mass, but it also put the position of this mass going that way, and we will see that dot will actually trace a circle, showing a connection between spring motion and uniform circular motion. So as this is going up and down, you can see this arrow here is indicating the velocity as that is going up and down. So this is moving up and down. There's your position. If I want position versus time, of course, I have to stretch the time out like I was suggesting before. This is what the graph should have looked like on my recording for my spring. Right, it should be a little smoother, but you know, when you're grabbing data, you're only grabbing at a finite number of points, and so you're going to skip a few points, and it's not going to look quite as nice. So here you have a nice shade. This is what a sine or a cosine function would look like if you were to graph one. Okay, and at the same time, we can see that this is going around, and you could look at the arrows here. The yellow arrow corresponds to the x component of the tangential velocity of that mass going around the circle. The y component corresponds to the y component of that tangential velocity. In fact, one can make use of that to derive the velocity for this mass going up and down. All we have to do is look at the component of velocity for uniform circular motion, and we can write that down. And the book actually does do that in its derivation. We're going to skip the derivation of that. Okay? So that's our little applet for today. And if you want to look at that, of course, you just go out to the website, right, under Chapter 10, and the applet is there, linking those two types of motion. All right, I just want to make sure I don't lose my tablet. Let's see. So if you're walking around here, be careful, I've got equipment on the floor. All right, let's summarize then some of the things we just saw. Okay, I suggested that we have sinusoidal behavior. Let me actually sketch it so we know what sinusoidal behavior looks like. So sinusoidal behavior, the graph of x versus t looks like sines or t. And there are different ways to actually write down x as a function of t. This. So the way we're going to do it is the following. I'm going to write x as a function of t. Position as a function of t. This is not multiplication. This is a function. You give me a time and I'll tell you where the mass is. Okay? We can compute this for particular types of behavior. Okay? And we'll write out what this looks like and I'll do a little sketch. We're going to use our A here. Okay, at t equals 0, we want to say that the position is at x equals A. All right, so we're going to have an A times something that evaluates the 1 at t equals 0, and that something happens to be cosine of omega.
And we'll start with
this. All right, A. This is called the amplitude. Omega, we can think of that as the angular velocity of that point mass going around the circle that we just saw. Okay, as one example, right? But this omega we saw earlier was actually related to the period. Okay, what is omega written in? What are the units typically? Radians per second. Okay, that's what omega is. What is frequency in units of? Hertz or 1/s, or cycles per second. So you will see frequency could be 1/s or s to the minus 1, hertz, etc. So if I gave you a frequency of a cycle per second, a cycle or a revolution per second, right? How many radians in a revolution? 2 pi. So if I were to convert revolutions per second to radians per second, how would I convert that? Okay. Revolutions per second equals how many radians per second? 2 pi. All right, but revolutions per second correspond to frequency. So many revolutions, one revolution is per second is a frequency. If I want to convert that, all I have to do is multiply by 2 pi. So we take 2 pi radians times 1/s will give me radians per second. So omega is 2 pi times the frequency, or 2 pi over the period, because the frequency is 1/period. So this omega actually has inside of it frequency or period. But it's much shorter to write this. Sometimes you'll see cosine 2 pi f t, but omega t is much simpler looking. All right. What if I wanted to graph the position versus time? Let's see, what do I get? Let's graph x versus t. Okay. So we can pick any frequency we want. That'll give me a particular omega. So omega is a constant. A is a constant. Question is, what is this graph look like? All right. If I put t equal to 0 in here, cosine of 0 is what? 1. So, at t equals 0, this is 1 times A, or A. So I have a point at A. Then I go in and I plug in more times. And I keep going until omega t becomes different values, right? Omega t is nothing other than an angle. Right? Omega t has to be in radians when you're doing this. So this is really theta, right? If you think about that motion of that mass going around the circle, it was going around at a constant angular velocity. And for constant angular velocity problems, theta is equal to omega t, which is something we learned in chapter 8. So this is cosine of some angle. We could go in and say, all right, what kind of angles can I put in here? Right, I could put 0. Let's see, cosine of, I don't know, pi over 2 radians. Well, pi over 2 radians is how many degrees? 90. Okay, so anyway, if we put our calculator to radians and ask, if I go out here to pi over 2 radians,
put in the right time here, so omega t is pi over 2. I take the cosine of pi over 2 and I get 0. So this comes down to 0. If I were looking at the mass oscillating, okay, when do I hit 0? Take this mass, let go of it, I'm at A. When do I hit 0? Oh, this part. How much of a cycle is that? Is that half the cycle? Am I halfway done? Right, if I were halfway, right? It goes from here, and then it goes to there. Is that, that's halfway up here, isn't it? So this is a quarter of the way through. So this is actually corresponds to a quarter of the period. Right? A quarter of a cycle is a quarter of the period in time. So as this is oscillating, a quarter of the way through, it's 0. And then we can go to halfway. Where am I halfway? Well, let's see. I pull it down as A. In this case, the thing is bad about this is that down is positive now. Okay, because naturally I pull things down. I don't push them up to let go. So it comes up here as a quarter. Halfway I'm up here, which corresponds to negative A. All right, so now I'm A away from where I started, away from equilibrium, but in the opposite direction from where I started. All right, then I go up to three quarters. Three quarters of the period, where am I? Let's see. It's one quarter. I go up to a quarter. That's a total of a half. Come back down. I'm at 0. Okay? If I were to actually put my time in of three quarters the period in here for the time with this particular omega, we can show that we do get 0. So let's try that. T is equal to three quarters of the period. Then cosine of omega T. There's cosine, what is omega? It's 2 pi over the period times 3 quarters, 3t over 4. The t's go out. And what am I left with inside? It's the cosine of what? 3 times 2 is 6 over 4. What's 6 over 4? 3 halves. So that's 3 pi over 2. Cosine of 3 pi over 2 is 0. So it actually works out that if I put in a time of 3t over 4 in here and use this expression for omega, then it all works out. All right, so I'm up to 0. And then if I keep going all the way up to a full period, I manage to get back up to the top. So if I put capital T in here instead of little t, then I have 2 pi over t times t. I'm just left with 2 pi. And so I've come full circle. Well, that doesn't tell you much. It's just a bunch of dots, right? But it is a function. I can put any time in here I want. And if I do so, I end up with a curve that looks like that. That corresponds to one cycle. That's what a cosine function looks like. So if you go to your graphing calculators, which you left at home, okay, then you can plot a cosine, and you will see that if I go further than one period, this just repeats over and over. Because now all I have to do is come out to 2t and take a snapshot of this, paste it on here, and I end up getting a copy of it. And it just repeats over and over and over. So that's what a sinusoidal function looks like. If I put a sine instead of a cosine here, we get some of the similar behavior. Okay, it's just actually a shifted cosine. That's why sine functions could also represent these. Okay. But for us, we're just going to say the position looks like this function of time. It has a particular amplitude, has a particular frequency of oscillation. All right, once we know what the position is, we can ask a few more questions. How fast is it moving? So what is the velocity? The book goes and does a derivation based on that little circular motion thing. If all you have to do is look at one of the components of the tangential vector velocity on that graph. We're not going to do that. Okay. Of course, the easiest way to do this is to use calculus, but we don't know calculus. So the next easiest is for me to just tell you. The velocity as a function of time is gotten very simply by multiplying by minus omega times the amplitude. Instead of cosine, it's a sine function. Right. If I were to look at this and ask what the velocity were, all I have to do is essentially look at the various slopes of this curve as I'm going through here, but I won't go through that. So this velocity, let's see if it works. If I put t equals 0 in here, what's the sine of 0? 0. So where this starts, when I pull it down, it has velocity 0. So at least that much we believe. Okay? But it would take a lot more for you to believe the rest of it. Okay. But we can write the velocity down. What do we know about the sine function? The sine function has a maximum of what? 1. The biggest a sine has ever gotten in this class is 1, right? So the biggest the velocity can get here would be what? Minus omega a. And then the sine goes all the way down to
negative 1,
which means negative 1 times this would give me plus omega a. So the largest value of velocity is very simply omega times a. This is the maximum velocity. Roger Brooks brought this out of the blue, right? So if you really want to know where that came from, just read your book. The acceleration is very similar. If I were to graph the sine function, it looks just like this. So to write the acceleration down, we bring out another minus omega. Another omega. Let's see. Yeah, just bring out an omega here, and we get acceleration as a function of time. Turns out to be minus omega squared a. The acceleration is actually proportional to a cosine function. Okay? Again, I'm just giving you this information. So the acceleration has a maximum value as well. Okay, but what's really neat about this is the following. This tells me the acceleration that the mass is undergoing when it's being pulled up and down by the spring. Right? If I know the acceleration, then what do we know? We know that the force is equal to the mass times the acceleration, right? What force is acting on the mass? Right, the spring force. So we have the spring force is the mass times the acceleration. We've already seen that the spring is minus kx. By Hooke's law. What I tried to convince you of was that the position takes this form. If we assume that the position is of this form, then the acceleration is of that form. So let's put those in and see what we get. We get minus k a times the cosine of omega t, that's kx, is equal to the mass times So take the mass times this acceleration. What do I get? Minus m omega squared a cosine omega t. And this is true for all time. But what's nice about it is there are some things on both sides of the equation that are the same, aren't they? Let's cancel a few things. What can we cancel? Get rid of the stuff we didn't want to see to begin with. Right? So, setting the mass times this acceleration equal to the spring force, we end up with, oh, we can get rid of the minus, we end up with K is equal to M omega squared. Let's solve this for omega. What do we have to do? Divide both sides by M. Okay, square root, and I get square root of K divided by M. What is K? K is a spring constant. M is the mass I put on that particular spring. If I increase the mass, I change omega. But remember, omega, even though this is the angular velocity, is related to something that's easy to measure. What's omega related to? Omega is related to things like the frequency of oscillation, the period. Okay? So if I go over there, I can actually say, oh, omega is 2 pi f. So let's do that. 2 pi f is the square root of k over m. So this is the main result here. That omega is the square root of k over m. If omega is 2 pi f, then this just gives me a formula for the frequency of oscillation. 1 over 2 pi, square root of k over m. So there's the frequency of oscillation. If you give me the mass and k, I can tell you the frequency of oscillation. Okay. We're going to verify this in lab. Of course, we're going to do is not verify that f is equal to this. But remember, f is 1 over the period. You can solve it. You can rewrite this in terms of the period. All right, springs are not the only thing for which we have simple harmonic motion. I actually really need 20 more minutes. Okay. As you're reading through the book, okay, you're going to find out that we also have pendula. So you can see the same thing. Pendula is a lot shorter. Okay, for pendula, you take a mass on a string, you pull it back and let go of it, and you watch it oscillate. Right? It also has a period. We're going to see that in lab. We're actually going to verify that simple harmonic motion as well. All right, so what we know up to this point. Okay, we know a little bit about simple harmonic motion for springs, and we know how to get the frequency or the period of that motion. Okay, so. And,